All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. It's CJ Wilson, joined by Josh Olsiewicz today. We are going to be talking about some kind of down the fairway stuff, but also some fringe stuff. I think it's important to understand that Bitcoin is not just one thing to one person and one type of person. There's a lot of new entrants. There's a lot of entrants from all different aspects of life. And before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about just the different types of people that are attracted to Bitcoin and why. So I guess, Josh, we can kind of kick it off because I know you want to ask me some questions, but I want to ask you first. Like, what was it about Bitcoin? What kind of markets were you into before you got into Bitcoin, I guess?
Yeah, so my background in 2013 certainly wasn't financial anything. I was maybe in a stock market club in middle school. So like that's my exposure. My family wasn't exposed to financial markets. Professionally or anything like that. So I had this account from elementary school that I'd started that was like for banking day. I don't know if you did banking day growing up at all, but it was like to practice like writing checks and like depositing into a bank. You know, it's like grown-up stuff, like legitimate things.
Like actual accounting. So you actually, right. You have a debit and a ledger and you're kind of going
exactly,
through
that. Exactly. Yeah. So that's where this initial like slug of money came from at that time. Cause you know, again, I was poor. I had nothing, right? I'm just a kid. This was like 10 years ago, out of college with debt and stuff. And it was just an alternative investing, not even get rich quick. Like I was really here for the technology. You know, I was really all about the decentralized aspect of it, especially coming out of like 08 and seeing what was going on with that nonsense. That's what really brought me in and kept me here. And then like the whole trading aspect of it and the financialization of everything, obviously that's why I stayed as well. But just the alternative nature of everything, you know?
Yeah. I feel you on that one. My big thing was I had a piggy bank, like a rusty brick colored piggy bank that I would put like quarters and dimes and dollars in or whatever. And I just cleaned out a storage unit the other day and I had it still. So I still have this thing. It's on my desk at my house. And I still have change in it from probably when I was, you know, a kid or something like that. And I think the aspect of savings was put into my head as a kid because I was like just materialistic enough to like cool things. You know, I had a poster of like a fancy car and stuff on the wall. And my mom liked cool things as well, but we didn't have like a lot of cool things. It was like just this aspirational deal, you know? But right. I always knew that if I saved up for something and I started early, then it would like lead to better quality life down the road.
Yeah, like the marshmallow test, right?
Yeah, the marshmallow test. I was 100% a two marshmallow kid for sure. I was like, oh wait, I can have more if I just wait. I will wait. I will sit here and I will just absolutely wait. When I got introduced to like the market, I guess when I was a teenager and you know, you get like your birthday money, 20 bucks, or you mow somebody's lawn, 10 bucks or whatever. I was compiling that because I was a hoarder. I was a saver, you know, and I had like a GT bicycle that I saved up for like 2 years. And I bought a $285 bicycle or something like that as like a 12-year-old. And then because like I didn't spend my money. If my grandma gave me 20 bucks, like I kept that. So like being really nice to my extended family was like a skill set, I think. And that's why yeah. I was like, hey, I need to get this extra 20 bucks here and there. And I was like all about doing chores. I was like, hey, if I, you know, like negotiating, hey mom, if I do the dishes, can you give me $1, you know, something like that. So she liked that I was, I guess, entrepreneurial or whatever. My brother was the opposite. He would sell his stuff. He would like, if he got like a baseball bat that he wasn't using anymore, he would like try to have a garage sale at the house or like trade it with somebody. He would always try to do like the bartering Turkish bazaar kind of like, oh, come on, buddy. No, I need this. You want that? I want this. Let's go. And I was like, I'm just going to save up and just accumulate things. And so I started trading actually when I was 13 because my grandfather, who was a super sharp guy, he was an engineering wizard, math guy. And he taught me how to do like technical analysis to a degree. And just from an unemotional standpoint, how to look at the range of an equity and just sort of like clip it, you know, just like take a little bit here and buy it back down there. And just, you know, look at something that has a long-term thesis and like let it play out. And so I started doing that and I made like a couple thousand dollars when I was in seventh and eighth grade. And I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. So that like mentality was always in my head, like, okay, I'm going to pick one thing and I'm going to study the hell out of it, and I'm going to ride it up and down and like not get greedy, not get emotional, and just sort of stay like that. And I think that when the markets crashed in 08, I guess it was, I was in the major leagues already. So I was already making really good money. But what I was doing at that time wasn't necessarily trading a lot. I was buying stuff that I felt like was going to be valuable, because it's back to the accumulation thing. I'm like, oh, well, I'm buying it at a discount, but I think at a long term, it's going to be good. So I got really into gold. And as a, you know, counterculture, hey, the government can't take it away if I can hide it well enough, you know, that kind of thing. So I would say that that's what sort of groomed me mentally. So I had the ability to ride the volatility of something. I had the ability to look at alternative things that weren't just mainstream and just, oh, put it in this portfolio, let some guy named Bob manage it and just let it go. A lot of my teammates did that, and I hated that idea. And they were all down 30 or 40% when the market got wrecked. So I was just piling up cash. And then there was a Porsche Carrera GT, which was like a $450,000 car when it was new. And some guy was nuked on it and sold it to me for like $330 in 2009. And that was the first year I made $1 million playing baseball. So I was like, okay, well, I can afford this now, kind of. It was a stretch. It's stupid. It's like a bunch of my salary. But I'm buying an asset that I like. And I'd already done pretty well with gold. So I was like, okay, well, maybe this is just the way I need to invest. So that's kind of how I look at Bitcoin as well. I look at Bitcoin as one of those things where, you know, as it drops, I'm like, well, long term, I know where I want it to go, and I think it's going to go this particular place. So my advantage is just being able to have just enough money to buy a couple grand a month, whether it's $1,000, $3,000, whatever. And I know I'm just going to spend that on Bitcoin every month. It's part of my mental budget. Like if I have a car payment that's, you know, totaling up to $1,500 or something like that, like I should be buying $1,500 of Bitcoin to offset that waste. You know, that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I mean that's classic dollar cost average mentality, right? Which is,
and I didn't even know what dollar cost averaging was. I just knew, right? You know what I mean? That like if I buy it and then buy it, if I sell it and buy it back and sell it and buy it back, if I ride that, then, and I'm putting a little bit in along the way and accumulating a bigger pile, then eventually it's just a really big pile and it's good. And I think maybe it took a long time for Bitcoin to settle with me, but that emotional component was already sort of like set. So I was just like, oh wow, this, I can just plop this right into my sort of emotional framework, and it kind of works. And then once I started looking at like a little bit more of the metrics and stuff, like what you do, I felt a lot more comfortable, you know, after, I don't know, maybe 2 years of trading Bitcoin or something like that, to say, listen, up market, down market, whatever. Like I'm thinking for 2040, 2050, you know, what my kids are going to have when I'm old. And hopefully it's a lot more Bitcoin than I have today.
Sure. Yeah. And then you got into the mining stuff too, which is a whole nother ball of wax, but.
Right. Cause at the end of the day, like if you can use the tax advantage of depreciating the miners, you know, and then accumulating Bitcoin along the way, and you get Bitcoin at, let's say it's even a 20 or 30% discount from spot, like you've done well, you know. I mean, ideally you'd get it for a 70%, you know, discount on spot. That's not totally realistic all the time. But I think the interesting thing about Bitcoin mining and accumulating Bitcoin through mining is by joining a pool, you know, you have a much more steady state return. And it's a lot different than if you're trading Bitcoin, which is really much more seat of the pants, have to stay on it like mentally all the time. And so now I'm trading my mining rewards, and now it's like, you know, but I wouldn't be able to do what I like to call fusion food unless I was really good at Japanese food and Mexican food. Before I do the Japanese Mexican fusion trading your Bitcoin mining rewards thing, like I would be like, that's a lot of emotional damage, you know, like the emotional damage, you know, like,
well, most miners are terrible traders from my experience of encountering and, you know, having conversations with them, which isn't to say like they don't have that ability, but for some reason they're just usually very emotionally connected to.
Well,
to
it's because there's always like a gun to your head, like, you know, Hey, give me more machines. I need to buy more machines. And then you have to look at it like, okay, there's a base level of machines that you have, but then there's these layers to investing and reinvesting the capital to say, okay, if I spend $100,000 on this many more machines or 500,000 or whatever it is, then like, what's my payback period? And if my payback period's decelerating, maybe I'm better off, like, you know, doing immersion. Can I do immersion on all my miners for that same thing and then get 30% more efficiency or something? And that might be at certain critical plateaus of size, that actually makes a huge difference. And so, you know, if you have 100 miners and you try to get 30 more miners, well, that's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars. But then all that's going to happen is your power bill is going to go up, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, and yeah, you're going to earn more Bitcoin theoretically, but like how long is between when you spend the money and they show up and then your hash rate goes up? Like there's that lag time. Whereas you can kind of go, you can pay for an immersion setup, it could probably get to you pretty quick. And then all your miners are better and they might last longer. So if your payback period is like, let's say 15 to 18 months or something like that, whatever it is today, then maybe your miners now, instead of running for 3.5 years, can run for 5.5 years or something. And
Right.
then, you know, or whatever. So this is part of the experimentation that I'm going through. This is the growing pains that I have as a miner. But I would say, like, as a trader, Bitcoin is a dream come true. It's volatile. It goes up and down like all the time. I'm in some of these like Telegram chats with other people and I'm like, man, it's like up 3% today. This is great because I can sell some and it's probably going to go back down to 28 and maybe I can buy some more there. And it just, you know, but if it goes up to 30,500 and I sell and I buy it back at 29,000, then like I'm killing it in my head, right? Because that's like, those are the returns that a fund manager on Wall Street would, they'd love to have that in like, I don't know, 3 months. They'd love to be able to make that much money in 3 months to, but because I'm only thinking how much more Bitcoin can I get? I'm not thinking about dollars at all. Like the
Right.
dollars are a waste. Like the dollars, I mean, Jerome Powell can do whatever he wants with the dollars. And, you know, that's, I
Yeah.
can't do anything about that. But if I get more
Right.
Bitcoin, then I feel like I'm really winning. And I think that's where, like, going back to the history and stuff like that, as an athlete, you know, I knew I had a finite supply of pitches to throw. You know, there's only so many bullets in the gun, so to speak. And so, like today, I don't know if some people are going to listen to this, they can't see it, but I can't bend my arm past like 90 degrees because there's so many bone spurs and stuff like that in my elbow. And even if I took them out, they would just grow back. So it's just like, all right, whatever. And that's kind of the resignation of an athlete in a way, is that, you know, because you get injured, because you go through like physical pain and difficulty and losses and, you know, shots to the knee and the head and whatever, you're gonna lose. You're gonna, at some point, the game is gonna end and you have to extract all the value from your career while you're playing. And the idea is if you can preserve that wealth in something. For me at the time, it was hard assets like gold coins or, you know, real estate or really like cool hypercars. But now it's really Bitcoin. And I know that there's a finite amount of Bitcoin. And I wish I would have gotten into Bitcoin when I was playing and I had so much more disposable income. And Bitcoin was obviously like, you know, $100 at the time or $60 or $12 or 6 cents or something like that.
Right.
Because the prime of my career, this like was from 2010 until like 2015. So that was like, it didn't matter when I would have bought Bitcoin. If I would have bought Bitcoin at any point along there, I would have done really well, especially with as much as I could have bought. As I should say, if I would have taken like one car that I bought and wasted money on or lost money on and just bought Bitcoin and said, that's the brain damage that you go through, you know, I think. But I
What we
would,
could have done.
right. But I think like it's interesting because, you know, Aaron Rodgers is making $40 million a year playing for the Packers. He's a Bitcoiner. You know, Tom Brady is apparently doing stuff with Bitcoin now. So there's some really big, like super duper high profile people, not just a guy like me who like made two All-Star teams, which is great, but like a Hall of Famer, you know, a current player that's a Hall of Famer, you know, like first ballot no matter what. Aaron Rodgers, first ballot easily, and Tom Brady 100%, you know. If those guys get into Bitcoin while they're making $40 million, you got to think that they could, I don't want to say like make a sailor position out of it, but they could afford, you know, because they've been making money for years. They could afford to just plop down 5 or 10 million bucks and just get a, you know, 100 Bitcoin or something like that. They could just do that. And that's a pretty significant number of Bitcoin to get. They could get, I mean, hundreds of Bitcoin, I guess, theoretically.
Yeah, definitely makes me curious, like how people like that come around to crypto and be Bitcoin specifically. You know, like do they have to be talked into it? Do they, you know, is it the mindset like you're talking about? You have a finite amount of pitches, you want to get the most bang for your buck, regardless, you know, diversification, whatever. Is it just the alternative investing mindset too? I think that's part of
it. I think the alternative investing thing comes from the fact that they're not Wall Street establishment families that are sending these guys to professional sports. Generally, you have, you know, kids from the hood, you have kids from suburban neighborhoods, you have kids from high school, people from the Dominican Republic, you know, you have like various ethnicities and various geographies represented. So it's not like everybody that I would say it's not like what you would imagine, like, let's say the PGA Tour, where the PGA Tour, it's like, you got to go to college on a golf scholarship. You know, you really have to like be a golfer and like have enough wealth to kind of work your way into that, just to be out there, because it's an expensive sport to get started in. But I think like football, because you can effectively get a free college, you know, so it opens it up to a lot of people that couldn't afford college, which then really widens the pool, you know. Yeah. If there's 300 Division I colleges in the country, I think there might be even more than that, but like 300, you know, teams times, you know, 85 players or something like that on a college team, then, you know, that's a lot of scholarships to hand out to people nonstop. And if they're able to, you know, make it to the NFL, then they have this opportunity, especially the NFL, because I think you're always confronted with your mortality, because the people on the other side are like really trying to jack you. Like, they're really trying to lay you out. Yeah. And it's competitive. It's very competitive. Baseball's a little bit different because you go through this like poverty stage where you go through the minor leagues. And so for 2 years, 5 years, 6 years, whatever it is, even if you do make it to the majors, there's months where you're making, you know, you get paid 5 months out of the year, and then you're getting paychecks for like $800, $1,200 for like your 2 week paycheck. And, right. I remember like being in AA in 2002, I guess it was. And I was like so happy that I got a raise to $1,900 a month, you know, and that's all I made. I was living in Tulsa at the time, making $1,900. I was staying at like the La Quinta Hotel. So then I would pack all my stuff in my car and then like check out of the hotel when we would go on road trips and like pray that my car didn't get broken into. And that's how I stayed it when I was there, you know, cause I was only there for like maybe the last 2 months of the season or something like that. So there was like this arbitrage to say, okay, I'm spending $650 a month on living expenses, you know, like in terms of the hotel, cause they would charge us like, I don't know, $35 a night or something like that to stay in like the La Quinta Inn. And then, you know, you're eating peanut butter and jelly at the field, you're eating some spaghetti, like you go through this phase where you're not making any money, and that gets you thinking, and that gets you like scheming and thinking like, okay, when I do get to the major leagues, I want to do this. And you hear guys go like, oh man, my wife said, as soon as I get my first big league paycheck, I got to get her a Chanel purse. And I'm like, you will be divorced 100%. Like, that's a terrible scam. And then you have other guys going like, yeah, I think like I need to get into real estate, you know, or like, oh, I just want to start buying stocks and things like that, because you have enough off time as a baseball player that you can really dive deep into like kind of any investment, and just like learn about some sector of investing, whether it's, you know, gold or Forex or, you know, Bitcoin or, like, try to think of what else, like meme stocks or something. Like, you could be a degenerate day trader as a baseball player.
Sure. I'm sure you got approached with offers and things, right? All the time.
Oh yeah. Like, I think, you know, it was all venture stuff. So it was always this stuff that I was like, there's no way that's going to work. There was a thing where I remember the dumbest one that I ever got approached by while I was playing was someone who was trying to come out with a better MySpace, and it was called I Spotted
Facebook?
You.
Oh, okay.
No, it's called I Spotted You. And so you were going to get like tokens, like little tokens. And then it had your like ID on it, like your URL. And then it's like, you'd be like, hey, what's up, girl? And like, that was the whole thing. And I was like, why are you paying? Like, what, where's the monetization of this? You know, like, how do you like, so yeah, you want me to put in money. They're like, well, yeah, you should just put in something small, like 30 to 50 grand. And I was like, that's actually a lot of money. You know, like 50 grand's like actually a lot of money. Even when you're in the major leagues, that's still a pretty freaking significant amount of cash to just like YOLO into something. And it was like, remember Pogs? Did you ever play Pogs? Oh, yeah. As a kid? Oh, yeah. So they were like little Pogs, and they would like, they said, oh, well, you know, you sign up for this thing, and then they like print your, they like print your image that you want, and then like, or like a logo, and then it gives you your URL. I was like, called business cards. And they were like, wait, no, this is different because this is social media. So someone like can like type your thing in. I'm like an email. And they were like, no. And like everything I said, I was like just popping these bubbles of idiocy. And they were just like, and they were going after all the Dominican guys. They were like this venture guy was going after all these Dominican guys. So he's like, you know, trying to sign them up. They're like, oh man, there's going to be so many chicks. It's going to be great. And the guys are like, oh dude, yeah, 30 grand. That's no problem. I'm like, let's go. And I was like, dude, you guys are going to get wrecked. And they're like, whatever, I'm rich, I don't care. And they would say stuff like that. I'm like, then you should just buy a bunch of Apple stock if you don't care. Like, this is like, buy a company, you know, buy like a blue chip stock and just let it sit there. But I think there was this natural distrust of Wall Street type of things because the image of a Wall Street person is like a nerd. And then the baseball player is like, I'm a physical specimen. I'm some tough guy. I'm so cool, you know? And then it's like, those guys would get, kind of like in Star Wars, like the AT-AT, you know, they would like act all tough. They had to shoot the lasers and they're all buff. And then Luke Skywalker like swirls them up with like a harpoon and a magnet and a string and they just topple over. And that was kind of like how all those guys got wasted on investments, was they thought they were so cool because they were like superstars or something. And I think the thing that I realized early enough, because I had injuries and stuff, was if I didn't make it as big as I wanted to make it as a baseball player, I was literally going to be a nobody. There was going to be zero people that cared about my story, my personality, my jokes, or anything about me if I was just a not like a baseball player that didn't make it. Mm-hmm. Whereas like a lot of these guys, they were sort of like counting their chickens way before they hatched. And, you know, that led them to making like bad investment decisions. I think just as a whole, that's the way sports is. You always have some guy that's like pumping you up, telling you the most amazing thing since applesauce. And then like, you're not, cause there's really only a couple Tom Brady's and, you know, Mike Trout's and, you know, Aaron Judge's and like these sort of like franchise level players, especially in baseball. There's maybe like one or two per team, you know? And if you're like the 14th guy on the team out of 40 guys, like you're definitely not the franchise guy. So, you just have to sort of be humble about that. And I think a lot of guys have a hard time with that, but baseball is really challenging and it's a daily grind. So it gives you this work ethic. And so if you survive the dregs of the minor leagues and you start getting a little bit of money, you get it late enough after seeing other people screw it up that mm-hmm. you can maybe come up with a little bit better strategy. And so when my strategy was, I had a debt servicing, I had a condo that I was debt servicing. So I bought it with a friend. We made a deal, whoever gets to the majors first buys the other person out so the other person can get cash and do something else. And then, but we rented it right away. And so that one move that I made when I was like, I don't know, 21 or something like that with my signing bonus, that was the best move I made financially until I was probably, you know, 28 years old or something, 27 years old. So it's like for 5 or 6 years, I didn't spend any money. I didn't invest any money. You know, I just did like a little bit of day trading or whatever, but it wasn't like, a career, you know, or anything mm-hmm. like that. It was like a hobby, like, oh man, Apple looks cheap. It's only $89. Let me buy some of that. And, but you know, you're having to go through like your TD broker or something like that. So it's more just like trying to, you know, save receipts, make sure you can have some tax, you know, refunds and stuff, and then, not waste it on stupid stuff and like too many Chanel purses for girlfriends or something.
But you knew enough and about enough that you didn't know much about anything. Right? So that's what like kept you away from the dangerous side of investing.
Yeah. And the one thing is I've always been very distrustful of other people, especially financially, because, when I was, I tell a lot of stories about my mom as an investor because she was kind of like she was a cautionary tale for me along the entire way. She passed away a couple of years ago, but, it's really funny when she was very in ill health, she had some health problems and she was still degen day trading Amazon stock. Like that was her portfolio, but she got wrecked in 99, 2000 when a company that she actually worked for went public. And I think they were trading on the Amex exchange or something like that. Like one of the, not the, it wasn't the Dow Jones or the NASDAQ. There's like another one. And it was trading on that. And then the company, one of the insiders was doing fraud and like the company tanked and like literally like Luna style, like just blew up and went to zero. And she lost all of my college money, all the money, like, cause she was like YOLOing that money. She had a retirement account. She borrowed from that, put it in this thing because she was like trying to buy the dip and it just kept dipping. And I was like, because I had already had experience as a trader, I got my grandpa involved because he taught me. And we had to, we tried to have like an intervention with her. We're like, don't do this. Like, you're YOLOing this money. It's not, she's like, oh, there's no way. I work there. Everything's fine. It's going to be okay. And then like, it just got smashed. She lost at the time. I think it was probably, you know, $200,000 or something like that, which if properly applied on the right risk metric would have been millions of dollars later, you know, because she would have had blue chip stocks and stuff that continue to do well. So seeing that as like a 19-year-old, knowing that that was what's possible, that people can kind of get addicted to the alpha and get addicted to some sort of like risk, you know, because they think that by being at the front of the risk trade that they're, you know, outsmarting everybody.
I mean, everybody's a genius in a bull market, right?
Yeah. So, but as it started dipping, she had this super false sense of confidence and, you know, and she had a job. This wasn't her job, but she would like do this on the side or whatever. And you know, it just wiped her out and it was really demoralizing. So when I got money and I was in the majors and you know, have all these like financial advisor guys come out of the woodwork and they're like, hey, I'd like to manage your money. Da, 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 da. I'm like, oh, I bet you would. Well, here's the deal. No one's going to manage my money. I'm going to learn what I need to do. I'm going to learn how to manage my cash flow. I'm going to learn how to manage my risk and my investments and stuff like that. Because if I lose $10,000 or 20% or whatever, I learn. If you lose 20%, I don't learn anything other than you suck and then I'm mad. And then that's it, right? Yeah. So that's literally what I would tell these guys. And they would be like, that's super ignorant. And I'm like, I think it's kind of based because I realize I don't know anything and I'm going to be cautious. I'm going to work my way into it. And I know I'm going to take losses. Like, how many people admit that, you know? And so now that's like kind of the thing. I like pretty much just do my own stuff. And as a result of that, I feel better about myself because the lessons that I learned, some of them were pretty expensive, you know, 20 grand here, 30 grand there, 50 grand there. They made those wins a lot sweeter. So when I did win money by like buying some of these cars and selling these cars, like, I mean, huge, like 2x or something like that, occasionally, I felt great about that. And I was like, oh, hey, financial manager guy, like, how was your 8% gain? I'm like, I made 300 grand on one car, like, you know. So, you know, it's because I felt like I earned that, you know. I literally spent thousands of hours digesting that. So, but I still thought Bitcoin was a scam. I still thought magic internet money was stupid.
Well, what turned the corner for you then? Like, what was it? Was it a person? Was it?
Yeah. So this is what's so funny, right? So the worst person I ever met in Bitcoin, like the worst one, it was like a scammer, actually. Like a scammer guy got me into Bitcoin. And this is so funny because, you know, I had heard about Bitcoin. Everybody did. Mt. Gox blew up. Ross gets arrested from Silk Road. This is national news, right? And I'm like, wow, this dude's going away forever. This is gnarly. And I'm like, I'm straight edge, right? So for me, from an ESG standpoint, right, I was like, oh, well, I don't drink. So they're doing drugs on, they're selling drugs on Silk Road for Bitcoin. Like, that sucks. Like, I can't get involved in that. And I didn't really get it. I didn't understand that was like not everybody, that was just some of the people. And then, you know, living in Texas, I guess you get a little bit more of a libertarian edge. Like, it might plant somewhere in you, and then it takes time for it to come out. But then in 2017, when the bull market really started taking off, and I was like, it was like, oh, wait, Bitcoin's $2,000 now. Like, what's going on? And then wait, hang on a second. It's $6,000. Like, what the frick? So, I was still very skeptical at that point. I never bought in, and it crashes, and like, I don't really think much of it other than it didn't go to zero. So I was like, okay, well, some people are like real believers in this stuff, so there must be something to it. This guy comes into my car dealership and he's like, yo, I want to buy a car for Bitcoin. And I'm like, all right, why should I do that? Like, why don't you just sell the Bitcoin and wire it to me, you know? He goes, well, you know, I trade on like Binance and it's like offshore, blah, 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 whatever. Because this was like back at the time before Binance really delisted the American addresses. So then he starts explaining like perpetual swaps and like BitMEX and all this other stuff. And I'm like, wow, this guy really knows this shit. This is kind of cool. And he's like, yeah, dude, just read the white paper. And he like blew me off. And I was kind of like, all right. So I read the white paper and I was like, I should get some of these Bitcoin. I didn't know they were limited to 21 million. So once I understood that was the trigger for me. It was really the finite supply of Bitcoin and how that gets enforced through the habiting mechanism. I was like, ah, that's cool. Like if I got, because so then, and Bitcoin at the time was like, I don't know, $3,800, something like that. I mean, that's when I bought my first Bitcoin on Coinbase for like, I bought like one Bitcoin for like 4 grand basically, plus including fees. And I was like, all right, cool, like I'm into this. And then I started trading it, and then I was like, wow, these Coinbase fees are brutal. This sucks. I need to figure out another way to do this. But I basically earned my way into trading by saying, okay, well, I'm going to give myself 5 grand. And if I don't lose it trading, then I'll give myself 10 grand, And I obviously had, more than 10 grand at the time. So it was like, it wasn't my whole portfolio. But I really kind of earned my way. And I said, okay, if I can turn my 10 grand into 13 grand in this period of time, then I'm just going to start putting more money in. And then 2019 comes around, and I think that's maybe when Binance US came out, and then Binance US had like super low fees, so I was like, all right, this is where I'm going to trade, and I like their interface and stuff like that. And yeah, so I signed up on Binance US and started trading like an absolute maniac, and I think I did like 10 or 20,000 trades in 2019, and then like 59,000 in 2020. And I'm back at it again. I didn't trade really at all last year. I just accumulated, but now the sideways action. I love the bear market. First, I love it. Like it's great because it just kind of does this, and so I'm just like trying to keep getting more, as it trades, and then I'm trying to sell a little bit, and then just keep trading like that. And it's hard, I think, for a lot of people to have that. What's the word I'm looking for? Maybe like detachment. Where you're gonna be trying to, you're happy when it's down, like you're happy when it's under 30 grand. Because I'm like, yeah, it's cheap, it's great. Like I can get over 3,000 sats a dollar. It's awesome.
Yeah, because people have the unrealized profits in their head as like their net worth, right? And so if it goes down, then there's this like loss aversion mentality. You got fear in that. People are just like not paying attention to the longer term and just getting caught up in price, and maybe they're here for the wrong reasons. Like who knows? But I was born throughout the bear market in 14, 15. I stayed here for did DCA all the way down, all the way back up. Like it didn't, certain people are here for a reason and survive for a reason in markets this volatile. And you definitely have to change your mindset towards why you're here, what you're doing, what are your goals, what is your plan, and stick to that. If you're good at trading sideways markets, then that's good. That's stick to that plan. Don't like have this fear or euphoria and throw everything in one investment without realizing the risks and stuff like
Yeah,
that. So.
and I think that euphoria thing is really kind of one of the dangerous deals about crypto in general. And I think that's a lot of athletes and musicians and performers and stuff get sucked into those other narratives because it's a story. And it's like, hey, you can produce something, and now instead of selling it for a dollar, you can sell it for $8. And every time those people sell it, now you'll get an extra dollar in residuals. And I think that that's a little bit dangerous because it obscures and like kind of sweeps aside all of the security concerns, all of the narratives, or just the factual information about scarcity. Because if, like, I always put it to you this way, like, all right, I don't always put it to you, I always put it to people this way. When I see a piece of art, right, or I hear a song, and I'm like, oh, I know exactly how they did that. Like, to me, it loses a lot of value, if that makes sense. Like, if there's not a mystery behind it, like, I don't know how Christian Bale loses a shit ton of weight and is looks like a toothpick, and then is amazing in The Fighter or The Machinist or whatever. Like, I don't know how he gets super fat and plays Dick Cheney. Like, I don't know how he could possibly do that and still live a normal life like afterwards. Like, how do you come back from each of those things? So for me, the mystery why I'm like, wow, he's an amazing actor, is because like I know he's doing something that I physically can't do. Like, I don't know how to do it. So when I see some sort of art or like a DJ or whatever, I'm like, oh, I know exactly what they're gonna do next. I know what this is, that is, whatever. I'm like, well, I'm just gonna do it myself. Like, I'm not gonna buy their stuff. I'm just gonna make my own, right? It's like if you go to a restaurant and you see them, like how they make some sort of dish, and you're like, I make it better than that. Like, I'll just put that on the wall, And I think artists are very much like that, and but then they get like competitive with each other to have more monetary success, and that's why they get into the crypto thing, and they get wrecked, They get wrecked in markets like this because the thing that you bought last year, I mean, why is it valuable? It's not valuable if someone like you and I can just make another one. You know what I mean? We can just kind of change something and make a new one. That to me is like a hard fork, right? And that doesn't really benefit. Whereas I think Bitcoin has this originality to it and this provability to it that the deeper you get into it, the more you feel safe from the because of the rules of Bitcoin and because of the transparency of Bitcoin. You kind of fall in love with it after a while. At least for me, I feel like the more I get into it, the more confident I get about it, and the more confident I am about like why it supports, anti-state, anti-censorship, that type of stuff. And I think that's what I mean. The world needs a lot of that right now, and we've given away freedom throughout that process, and that's why I think you have this sort of like coalition of preppers, in Bitcoin, and people that are like, kind of they're not even left or right. They're just like removed. They just want to be completely out of the system,
Right.
and I think those people are kind of like beacons or oracles for us. They're like lighthouses. They're like freedom lighthouses because they say, hey, listen, like when we had Lop on and he's talking about all this stuff, and it's like, dude, this guy's been through all of it. He's
Yeah.
and he's standing way up high, you know what I mean? In a tower, shining the light for everybody, saying, watch out for the rocks, watch out for the bridge, watch out for the pier. This is what's coming, everybody. And he's like warning everybody, like literally, like a lot of his actions are warnings. And I think that's super valuable, but you don't have that in any of these other investments. You don't have people warning you how to not screw up and not crash and not get ripped off. You have people basically trying to soothe you into,
With their
this,
siren song to get you
yeah, the
in.
siren song. And so you have the Warren Buffetts or the Ray Dalios, or even worse, the Grant Cardones, the people like that, that are just absolute sirens, just crashing people under the rocks, or Gary V's. Because it's like, oh yeah, you could just hustle. Just get like five jobs. Like fuck sleep. You don't need to sleep. Like fuck friends. You don't need those. You want money. Because without money, life sucks. And it's like, all right. Like I don't know. It seems a little weird. And your vibe is a little strange. I'm not like sure I like that tone. And then you have guys like Jimmy Sung that are like, hey, I want to have a big family. I like eating meat. I like working out. I'm trying to be a good person. Bitcoin's rad. I want to teach more people about it. And it's like, all right, I like that. That's cool. And I think the quality of people you get in that regard, like the character really, it really stands out from the sort of Wen Lambo Moon Boys, the TikTok
Yeah.
investing group or something like that. So I just Bitcoin just feels mature. And when people say, oh, it's boomer tech, I'm like kind of, oh, you mean like the automobile or the internet? Like, I mean, some of these boomer things like airplanes or space shuttles, like they work out pretty well. We don't have to like reinvent everything. Like when somebody builds a backyard spaceship, I'll listen to them. That boomer tech's not a good idea. But like refining hard things is like a really good way of building lasting wealth and, and good family structure and stuff like that. So that's I don't know if you can relate to that or
Yeah,
not.
no, people here are different here for different reasons, right? For some people it's banking, for some people it's payments, for some people it's investing, for some people it's all three, right? And it depends on how you value what you're doing here. And people always ask me, like, how do you value Bitcoin? I'm like, well, it's kind of like Visa, it's kind of like oil, it's kind of like gold, it's kind of like JPM, like JP Morgan, it's kind of like all this stuff kind of combined, you know? So yeah, the people here, some people are here for the wrong reasons, some people are here for the right reasons. So
Yeah, I think the weird part though, bringing it back to the athlete thing, is like people know exactly how much money you make as an athlete or as a movie star or something like that, because I don't think people really know how much musicians make. Maybe that's a little different, but literally it'll be like, hey, Chris Pratt is getting paid $8 million to do Guardians of the Galaxy 3, or Will Smith's getting $20 million to do this movie or something, or Mike Trout's making $40 million to play for the Angels. I think that's so weird if you just think about that for a second, because it strips you of all your modesty. It's like having nudes on the internet, but of your wallet. And with Bitcoin, I think at least you have the chance to like put it in different places so that no one can say, oh, that's where it is, and I think that modesty with athletes, I think some of them that are really grounded, they're attached and attracted to that modesty financially. They don't really want to have the purple chameleon race car that they drive every day. They don't want to have the chrome plated Hummer or something like that. When I played, I wanted the rainbow purple, you know, supercar, because I was like, hey, this is what I've wanted my whole life. I love it. And I wasn't really scared of that, but I was also not the number one guy on the team, if that makes sense. So for me, it was just more like a flair, like, you know, like wearing a really colorful pocket square or something like that. I just wanted to have that identity, I guess, that shtick. But I think there's a lot of these guys, they're looking at it from a generational wealth perspective because they didn't come from money. And so they're thinking like, maybe Bitcoin, this thesis that everybody has, Bitcoin's going to go up long-term really high. That's a good way to make sure that my kids are taken care of. You know, that's a better version of the 529 college fund or something like that. So they have these people that are kind of directing them, and they'll be like, okay, Mr. Rogers, you can just YOLO $1 million or whatever if you want to. And then Cash App is like, hey, we'll match you 500 for 500 if you want to like do this or something. I mean, you got to figure that there's some participation there. And it's just so, I don't know, it's so cool that that there's people advocating for Bitcoin on that level. Cause otherwise it literally just comes across as a bunch of conspiracy theorist memers, you know, on Twitter. And we need, if we really want mass adoption, we need to have tools for mass adoption. And we also need to have profiles for mass adoption to say, hey, this is a way you can get in. And, you know, and that's why it's cool with like what Valkyrie does, where they have trust in different things. You know, Swan has the DCA thing, so you can actually like auto buy or whatever. So some of these things, I think they, some of these other, let's say non Coinbase things, they, or non exchange things, they have a way of normalizing Bitcoin so that it's not such a heavy, you know, run your own node, mine, you know, build a mining rig in your basement or something like that. Cause that's like, man, like 2014, I can't imagine how bad the experience, the user experience was to be a Bitcoiner. It must have been like, it's nowhere near as good as it is now, obviously, right?
No, things have definitely changed, you know. Wallets have changed, UIs have changed, even Coinbase, which used to be not as great as it is even today. Like it was much worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, things have definitely changed for the better. You know, all these forward facing new generation of apps and things for sure.
But I think that's one of the cool things about the space in general is that we all believe it's going to grow a lot in terms of users. So it makes sense to take risks to build something for those people. You know, if you say, hey, I've got this thing, I'm going to make five of them. People are like, well, cool, you have five customers. Like, we're not going to invest in that. But if you say, hey, if I build this thing well enough, we might get 100 million users. Well, now you all of a sudden you have a serious product, right? And you have a serious subscription model and things like that. And, you know, at some point there will be this sounds bad because their stock performance recently, but like there will be like a Netflix of Bitcoin where people will just sort of have an automatic billing thing and they won't even think about it. You know, they're just going to contribute, whether it's from their salary or, you know, a gift from like a grandparent or something like that. And then I think when people like that are our age become grandparents, you know, like what's Bitcoin going to be then? And I think about that all the time. Like when I'm 70, you know, I see my dad, I'm teaching my dad about Bitcoin. He's reading all these books and stuff like that. And he's like really fascinated by it. He's like dark. So if I can teach my boomer dad to do it, then maybe one day, you know, the people that are parents now, when their kids are parents, then like what's Bitcoin going to be at that point? It'd be really cool. Hopefully it's still super secure, but we might be on like layer 3 or 4 by then. Depending on how crowded the mempool is.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think we got to leave it there.
All right, Josh. Well, good talking to you today on the Bitcoin Bottom Line. For those of you listening, DM us, slide into our DMs and let us know what kind of topics you want to hear about and engage. We are more than happy to chase certain guests down and talk about certain topics that you think are important. And whether it's trading or saving, you know, this is also not financial advice, so make sure you do your own research.